This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Adjustment Day by Chuck Palahniuk. Narrated by Corey Allen. A quote from John Adams. Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. People still talk about some do-gooder, a good scout, the one in every crowd. Some altar boy, some teacher's pet walks into the southeast precinct, looking both ways, whispering with one hand cupped beside his mouth. Past dark o'clock, it's midnight o'clock, when in walks the kid with his hood up, head down, wearing sunglasses no less. He's nobody Stevie Wonder. No white cane, no dog. Whisper asks, can he talk to somebody in charge? Ask the desk sergeant on duty. Whispers, I want to report a crime that's supposed to happen. The desk sergeant's being, got some ID. Wearing a ball cap with the brim pulled low. His hood pulled up to the top of the ball cap. Only his nose and mouth showing, this party pooper, concerned citizen. Sweating dark patches through the back of his sweatshirt, he's all, it's not me telling you, okay? Shaking his head. Not in public, either. So Mr. Desk Sergeant, he calls somebody, makes a big performance of pressing a button, picking up his telephone and touch-toning, never taking his eyes off the kid in the sunglasses, sergeant asking can a detective come down to the lobby and take a statement. Yeah, a possible tip. Sergeant looks at the kid's hands he can't see on account they're shoved in the front pockets of his hoodie. Not a good sign. Sergeant always head nodding, pointing with his chin like, want to keep your hands where I can see them. The kid obliging, but shifting his weight from foot to foot like he forgot to take a leak for the past 100 years. Craning around like he's expecting somebody to walk in off the street behind him. Kids all, I can't be exposed here like this. This kid, his arms hang straight while he's hyperactive from the waist down, like he's in Riverdance, or like he's doing porn, the same way a porn star keeps that camera sidearm slack, pulled back paralyzed while his hips buck, like that one arm is attempting to flee the scene in understandable humiliation. Sergeant on duty being, empty your pockets. Waving this goody-two-shoes in the direction of a metal detection tunnel deal, same as at any airport. This Eagle Scout extricates his wallet and phone and puts them in the plastic bowl. After a long hesitation, his sunglasses. The regular Homeland Security routine. The kid's eyes twitchy. Blue eyes under worried together brows, making a face that will give him wrinkles one day. In the police station there's a sound like a pop, like a shot, like a gun going off only muffled. Maybe outside. Kid jumps. Most definitely a gunshot. Detective's like, you high, son? Kid's got this look like he's just seen the wrong person naked riding a bicycle from behind. His voice falls off a cliff, going shrill all the way to the bottom. He says, can I have my wallet back? Detective's all, first things first. The detective goes, you hear about the upcoming assassinations? And the kid's like, you guys know already? The detective asks who else the kid is told. And this useful member of society, this kid, he says, just my folks. The detective gives back the kid's wallet, his keys and sunglasses and telephone, and asks, can the kid call or text his folks and persuade them to come here, to the precinct, right this moment? The detective smiles. If you got a minute, I can answer all your questions. He jerks his head toward the camera on the ceiling. Not here. Detective leads this kid, America's newest hero, down a concrete hallway, down a fire stairs, through a couple of metal doors marked authorized persons only. Leads the kid to a metal door. Unlocks it with a key. Throws the door open. This kid's folks, they text they're coming down to help him. They text not to be scared. Inside the metal door, it's dark and stinks. A backed-up toilet stink. Kid follows the detective. His folks text there in the lobby. Here's the best part. Detective flips on the lights. This snitch, the tattletale, sees piled in the center of the room a heap of bloody clothes. Next he sees the hands attached to each sleeve. It's only clothes and shoes and hands because the heads and faces have been obliterated. A distant voice, muffled from another room, says, "The only quality that truly unites us is our desire to be united." It's then our altar boy turns to the detective for help and sees nothing except the muzzle aimed point blank at his own face. Soon as the locating service scans for pipes and buried electrical cables, he gives the go-ahead to dig. Spencer's rental trucks over the backhoe. They're one with the largest bucket. The job's just half dug when sauntering across the practice fields comes somebody too old to be a student. Somebody tenured. Some busybody in those India print cotton drawstring pants. Leather sandals and socks. Wearing a sweatshirt printed with the words, "This is what a feminist looks like." Something rolled up and tucked under his arm. He's got the usual gray beard and eyeglasses. Once he's yelling close, Greybeard raises his arm and waves, shouts, "Nice day for it!" Yes, and a ponytail. Sauntering across the soccer pitch, bald except for the gray ponytail hanging halfway down his back, sparkling in the sunshine, an earring. One dazzle-bright diamond earring. Specifications call for excavating a rectangle 300 by 30 feet, 12 deep, with the bottom leveled and layered with 2 feet of impervious clay. On top of that, a seamless barrier of polyethylene sheeting to retard possible leakage into the water table. This site, here, a minimum of 500 yards from any potable well or open watercourse. These are the same specs they're using nationally. The same specs as a holding pond at a mill, only minus the compressed clay hardpan the EPA would normally require. Rolled up under the graybeard's arm? It's a yoga mat. He goes, "What are you gentlemen undertaking here?" A professor slumming it among the proles. Rufus goes, "Campus improvement?" How he says this without laughing, who knows, but he's all, "Long-term underground parking for faculty." Naylor laughs. Only he puts a fist in his mouth and pretends it's a cough. Osterman gives him a harsh look. Professor is all, "Call me Brawley. Dr. Brawley." He offers a handshake nobody accepts. Not at first. Naylor looks at Wise. Rufus hefts his clipboard and flips through the thick stack of paper it holds. Professor's hand hovers until Osterman shakes it. Rufus shuffles his pages, being, "Brawley. Brawley." His fingertip traces down some list, and Rufus goes, "You teach something called the arrogant legacy of privileged Euro-colonial cultural imperialism?" Professor nods to indicate the clipboard, him being all, "May I ask to what you're referencing?" Not missing a beat, Rufus comes right back with, "Environmental impact study." Naylor and Wise both guffaw. Total jackasses. They turn their backs to everybody until they can regain a professional composure. They're still snickering until Osterman goes, "Don't be dicks." Professor, red-faced behind his beard. He shifts his yoga mat from under one arm to under the other, going, "I only ask because I serve on the University Committee Against Wounding the Earth." Consulting his lists, Rufus is all, "Vice chairperson, it says here." Naylor excuses himself to go inform the backhoe operator of the need to slope the west side of the excavation, seeing how that's the side the dump trucks will be filling it from. Nobody wants it to slump under that kind of weight. Wise leans on his shovel, nodding to get the prof's attention, going, "Nice sweatshirt." Arm up, sleeve pulled back to show a wristwatch, prof makes a big show of checking the time, being like, "I'd still like to know what you people intend." Nose still stuck in his paperwork, Rufus goes, "Your office still in Prince Lucian Campbell Hall, 6th floor. Prof looks rattled. Wise goes, "That a real diamond?" Stuck through Prof's left ear, so perfect. The soccer grass runs right to the edge of the dig. Under that shows a little margin of dark brown topsoil. Below that is a yay-wide stripe of subsoil, with under that, ancient history, dinosaur deep. The bell tower over by the administration building begins to toll 4 o'clock. Prof goes down on one knee, right at the edge of the hole. Nothing but raw dirt, going down deeper than a swimming pool, deeper than a basement. Dirt and worms. The steep sides clawed with stripes from the teeth on the bucket. Little clods bust loose and roll to the bottom. Kneeling there, the professor leans out over the drop, contemplating what he can't understand. He could be looking for fossils. Dumb as a hog led to slaughter, not recognizing the obvious, but trying to identify some last trace of a vanished civilization. Whatever the case, he's getting a good long lingering look at everything pitch dark he spent his entire life pretending doesn't exist. The bits of breakfast cereal clung to his skin like fruit-flavored scabs. He peeled off a red-flavored one and ate it. It left a ghost on his arm like a tiny round red tattoo, like he was turning into a rainbow-colored leopard. That morning, Nick wakes up in bed, with spilled Fruit Loops sticking to his back, little circle stains and rainbow colors like lifesavers printed on his sheets. He reaches his phone off the floor to try and reconstruct his evening before. "Reward offered for information," it reads. A text that came through a few minutes after midnight. He tries to return the text, but it's a blocked number. He's not out of bed before the phone rings. The caller ID says, "Private." Nick thumbs the screen and is like, "Talk to me." A voice goes, "Nicholas?" A male voice, but not Walter's. Not his dad either. Raspy and wheezing, but cultured. Nobody Nick knows calls him Nicholas. He lies, "No, this is Nick's friend." He needs to piss. On the phone, he's all, "Nick stepped out." The telephone man is, "Allow me to introduce myself." Rasping, "My name is Talbot Reynolds. By any chance, do you happen to know the whereabouts of a Miss Shasta Sanchez?" Wheezing, "That most captivating and lovely of creatures." Nick lies again. "Can't help you." Over the phone. "You are acquainted with the enchanting Miss Sanchez." And Nick's all, "Nope." "Have you recently been contacted by either the police or one Walter Baines?" asks this Talbot person. Nick's getting the picture. Walter. Walt the screw-up. The lame, helpless loser. Every overdose or car crash, it went this way without fail. The time Walter did bath salts and tried to eat his hand, it was Nick who had to take him to emergency. Or worse, when he tried to drill that hot Satanist. Not bothering to hide the anger in his voice, Nick goes, "Never heard of him." The voice over the phone sounds echoey, as if calling from a hole somewhere. This Talbot says, "Be assured, I am an exceedingly well-off individual who would pay greatly for any assistance you might offer." Nick's fingers feel among the bedsheets until they come across something round. A 10-milligram Flexeril, by the size of it. By reflex, he brings it to his mouth without looking and chews it without water. If this phone call is a drug deal, Nick frets he might get dragged into it. The events of last night continue to be a little foggy in his head. He's waited too long. Long enough for somebody to triangulate the signal from his phone. Time enough for somebody to be knocking at his door. He gets all, "Let me take a message for Nick." "Tell him," the voice says, this Talbot, "not to go to the police." After only the slightest of hesitations, "Assure him that everything will be resolved in a few days." Already feeling his muscles loosen and relax, Nick goes, "What's Shasta wrapped up in this time?" The voice, this well-heeled geezer, Talbot, he's asking, "May I have your name?" Only Nick ends the call. He slips out of bed and squints to see through the bedroom curtains. Nobody stands at his door. Not yet. He pulls a green-flavored Fruit Loop off his arm and chews it, thinking. Before anything else, he swipes and thumbs to deactivate the GPS on his phone. As an added safety measure, he snaps open the back and slips out the battery. Rows of folding chairs are set up. Even so, there's people left standing along the edges and across the back. In that big box sporting goods place, the one with the waterfalls and trout stream for indoors fly fishing. Only it's after hours, so the waterfalls shut off, and the stream is just dry fiberglass pools with the trout tucked away in tanks behind the scenes. Like Mother Nature's gone home for the night, there's no soundtrack of songbirds or recorded trumpeting bull elk. Bing and Esteban check out the crowd. Mostly a bumper crop of Bubba types, a smattering of Jamals, an army of lone wolves. Across the audience is that one douche from the gym, Colton something, sitting with his significant other, Peggy, or Polly. Facing the crowd is some man asking, "By a show of hands, who knows why people crop the ears of dogs?" Before anybody can answer or even raise a hand, he gets revved up about how ancient shepherds cropped the ears of their puppies to prevent infections, to prevent wolves from taking hold during fights. Shepherds used the same scissors they sheared their sheep with. They grilled the snipped bits, cooked them up, and fed them to the same dogs to make them fierce. No shit. Sporting goods guy, he asked the crowd, "How many of you know ancient Assyrian law?" He gets no takers. Charging forward, he's all, "The Babylonian code of Hammurabi punished lawbreakers by slicing off their ears." For extra credit, he goes on how King Henry VIII punished 16th century vagrants by cropping their ears. That an American law allowed folks' ears to be lopped off as punishment for sedition or moral offenses as late as 1839. Making his point, he goes, "It shouldn't surprise you none that since the beginning of warfare, mercenaries have collected ears to exchange for their pay." Bing puts his hand up, going, "Sounds bloody." Sporting goods guy shakes his head, going, "Not." He points up an index finger to make folks wait. "If your target is dead." "The chief advantage of taking scalps," he goes, "is they're lightweight. Easy to harvest and transport. The downside is they're messy. The same goes for hearts. Claiming a heart is slow going. Ears, on the other hand, ears are ideal. The left ear, to be specific. Ears are portable in large numbers, easy to conceal. 100 ears hardly strains a paper shopping bag. That amounts to 300,000 possible votes. Practically being your own political party." Sporting goods guy He turns his head sideways to everybody and goes, "Grab hold." He means his ear. Esteban looks around. Nobody's grabbing, so he finally steps forward and grabs the man's ear. It feels warm and stretchy. The man says, "Give it a good tug." He drills them on the regulations. Only the left ear counts. The left. Only ears on the list. Random DNA testing will be utilized, and if you're found to have submitted an ear not on the list, then you're facing the death penalty. Ears may not be exchanged or sold, and only the person harvesting the ear may submit it for voting credit. Sporting goods guy yaks on about bullfighters, about ears being the body's heat radiators. Esteban standing there. He's holding on to the guy's ear like it's cash money. "Plus," the guy goes, "ears are durable." "Even with a headshot, the ear. You might have to hunt for it, but the ear will remain intact." To Esteban, still tugging on his ear, he goes, "You may resume your seat." The way the sporting goods guy explains it, the ear is mostly the outside part. The pinna is composed of cartilage of the elastic type. That and the outer perichondrium, which supplies blood and lymph. As easy to slice as a tire. "The best method," he goes, "is to slice downward from the helix junction to the lobe." He goes, "If you can slash a tire, you can harvest an ear." Sporting goods guy gets to maintaining how folks need a straight-edge, fixed 4-inch blade with a full tang. No fancy leather handle or bone or wood, but an easy-to-grip polymer. Such is his job, selling stuff. "What you want is a high-carbon stainless steel. No partial tang knives. Partial tang knives tend to break. Folding blades break. A man can harvest all the targets he wants, but if his knife breaks, what's the reward?" Sporting goods guy is all, "The day comes, people will use their kitchen shears. But how are they going to head home and cut up a chicken with the same tool they took ears?" Loud, too loud, Esteban goes, "Amen!" Folks laugh. This being Esteban's brainstorm, them becoming warrior kings and all. His thinking is most men won't team up. Men, they're freelancers. Like in olden days, those knights for hire. Your typical man, he'll try to hit a target and harvest the ear, himself. Alternating tasks requires him to constantly shift gears, slowing him down. The solution, Esteban goes, is for labor specialization. Bing's a crack shot, Bing is, so he'll put down the target while Esteban does the harvesting. Together, they're a hit-and-harvest duo. Together they can establish the foundation of a glorious dynasty to last forever. Their kids and their kids' kids' kids will be crowned royalty. The adjustment being one last shot at doing something useful with their lives. Theirs was just like Nat Turner's rebellion, or John Brown's raid, a legacy. Come the new crusades, the one-day crusade, and they'll claim something comparable to the knights who'd been awarded estates. But a power set to outlast both land and money. Become royal blood. With a shopping bag crammed full of ears, they'll take their place in history. Esteban and Bing and their descendants will control a most mighty nation for the centuries to come. Back in his chair, Esteban removed a tissue and tube of cocoa butter from his coat pocket. He was a sleek apex predator now. If he was going to give up a lifetime of getting hand-me-downs and leftovers, he'd need to get that man's waxy ear stink off his fingers. Shasta didn't turn around. She was accustomed to college boys trailing her through the halls between classes, eye-raping her French vanilla curves, ear-raping her with the shouts of, Let's mount Shasta. These rambunctious douchebags shouting, how'd you like to summit, Shasta? They'd pull at her dreads and shout, Shasta, let me get below your tree line. At this, she turned. She hoped it was Walt. It sounded like Walt's voice. But when she looked, it was a burner type whose breath smelled like a torched party bowl of cheap kush. He lunged at her, his tongue out and lips pursed, trying to steal a kiss. The stoner went, I'll miss you, Shasta. Confused, she was all, but I'm not going away. She sidestepped as he tried to swat her bottom. Then she realized that he was leaving. This sad burner dude, he was going to die. All the college boys were going to die painful, awful, horrible deaths. The poor guy. They were all to be pitied. Here at the University of Oregon, no matter how intense the teasing grew, she didn't take it seriously. These boys, even those who tried to pinch her yoga pants, she knew for a fact they acted out simply because they were terrified. Dr. Brawley, who taught patterns in politics, had explained as much. For all incoming freshmen, he'd led a module examining a book by some German brain case. The smarty pants academic, Gunnar Hinzone, theorized that all major political upheavals in history were due to an excess of young males. A youth bulge, the savvy Kraut called it. Teaching the concept left Professor Brawley breathless with excitement. The basic idea held that if at least 30% of a population consisted of males between the ages of 15 and 29, watch out! Such surplus young men, if they were somewhat educated and well-fed, they yearned for status and would create havoc in pursuit of it. Gunnar held that starving people don't strive for recognition. Likewise, illiterate boys will never recognize how history ignores them. But if the youth bulge is fed, well-fed and schooled, they'll become a pack of ravenous, attention-seeking wolves. For his favorite example, Dr. Brawley cited Spain in 1484. That year the Pope, Innocent VIII, declared that any form of birth control would be punished by death, and the size of the average Spanish family jumped from 2 children to 7. Only the firstborn male would inherit family assets. Female children expected little at the time. But extra male children crave status, power, recognition, and social position. It was this surge of young men who called themselves segundones, in English, secondaries. It was these men who spilled into the New World with Christopher Columbus's second expedition and became the legions of conquistadores, who enslaved and pillaged the innocent Maya and Aztecs. If Wikipedia was to be trusted, Gunnar Hinzone had been born in Poland in 1943, which officially made him super geriatric. To Shasta, even with his shaggy blonde hair and cool Euro name, he was only medium hot. Throughout history, Dr. Brawley lectured, similar bulges of rambunctious youthful men had toppled governments and triggered wars. 18th-century France experienced a population surge that increased the demand for food. Prices rose, citizens revolted, and the frustrated young people overthrew the Louis XVI aristocracy and lopped off Marie Antoinette's bejeweled head. Same deal with the Bolshevik Revolution. It was set in motion by a flood of extraneous sons from the countryside who had no farmlands to inherit. In the 1930s, Japan experienced a youth bulge that spurred the invasion of Nanking. In turn, Mao's revolution was powered by a male youth bulge in China. Shasta had absorbed every detail. Clearly, every bad event in human history had been caused by a surplus of cute young boyfriend material. According to the Council of Foreign Relations, between 1970 and 1999, some 80% of civil conflicts occurred in nations where 60% of the population was younger than 30 years old. At present, there were 67 countries with so-called youth bulges, and 60 of them were suffering social upheaval and internal violence. as if in league with Brawley, Miss Pettigrove, who taught generalities of gender, lectured that every conflict that culls the male populace increases the social value of men. In turn, this catalyzes a rebirth of the patriarchy. With fewer men to choose from, women go boy crazy and toe the line for anything wearing pants. It didn't take much brain power to realize why the male student body at the University of Oregon strutted about, brash and loud, but secretly terrified. The United States was only days away from ratifying a declaration of war with the Middle East. That region was enduring its own burgeoning bulge of young males, while the United States was struggling with the hyperactivity and status demands of the millennial generation, arguably the biggest boy bulge in world history. In Miss Lanahan's class, Biology of Animal Dynamics, she showed them a video about animal rights, filmed by PETA or somebody. It showed a poultry farm where super cute newly hatched chicks were checked for their gender. The baby hens were placed under warming lamps and given food and water. The baby roosters, they got dropped down a dark chute. They piled up in a dumpster, so deep, they formed a fluffy, seething mass, each chick struggling to stay alive. A forklift carried the dumpster into a barren farm field and poured it out. There, the male chicks, alive and dead alike, were plowed under as organic fertilizer. The young men in the class had howled with laughter as the teeming, peeping flood of Easter cuties spilled from the dumpster. The tiny yellow balls of fluff stumbled, terrified and cold, across the bare dirt. In a twinkling, giant tractor tires and thrashing farm machinery pulverized every adorable new life. The boys laughed, Shasta knew, not because it was funny, but because the chicks were themselves. How could these teenagers focus on learning collage and art or ballroom dancing and phys ed when, with the stroke of a government pen, their lives were about to be over? Everyone knew it. Their 18th birthday had been a death sentence. This was how politicians had always dealt with the burden of surplus men. It made Shasta sad, really. Really sad. These loud-mouthed jocks and stoners and nerds, they were dead men walking. As soon as the declaration of war was ratified, it was so long, male millennials. Hello, newly robust patriarchy. The boys who trailed the hallways behind Shasta trying to snap her bra straps and peppering her with sexually suggestive invectives, they were all registered for military service. Most of them would be shipped off to be bullet-raped by enemy combatants. So whenever Shasta started to take umbrage at their harassment, she considered how most of them would soon be bulldozed beneath arid dunes, with like numbers of boisterous and extraneous Middle Eastern boys. She'd scamper through her coursework while her male peers would be conscripted. Their muscles and pimples would be mangled under tank treads and blasted into screaming pieces by landmines, just like the buried alive, just-hatched baby roosters, whose only crime had been being born the wrong gender. She would go on to earn her degree in social work, just the beginning of a rich, long life. And she'd always remember to wear a poppy pinned to her lapel every Remembrance Day. Behind her, a voice hissed, "Shasta." She turned, ready to upbraid some new accoster. But she was wrong. Here was Nick, a one-time boyfriend. Nick, who dropped out at the end of first semester reasoning that he didn't need physics and calculus too for a successful future career as shattered, bloodied cannon fodder. It was nice to see him. To judge from the wan half-smile on his face, he was happy to see her as well. Before the moment could turn into anything sticky and romantic, he asked her, "Have you seen Walter lately?" Walt was her current boyfriend. He'd also dropped out of school. He worked at Starbucks, earning a few dollars and trying to enjoy the precious smidgen of life left to him. No, she hadn't seen him. Not since the day before when he'd been ranting about some grassroots mass murder conspiracy. "First off," Nick went, "if the police ask, you haven't seen me." He took her hand and pulled her toward an empty storage space beneath the school's south stairs. He was being all, "Shasta Sugar, we need to talk." He reached out and brushed the dreads away from her face. "Honestly, I'm not going to date rape you." Shasta allowed herself to be pulled in. Gregory Piper had received a second callback. His agent was thrilled. The part he was reading for was a character named Talbot Reynolds, a fictional monarch who ruled a near-future utopia of warriors and maidens. Talbot existed above corruption. The character was an immortal, a political saint of sorts, a principal role in some television pilot in pre-production. It went without saying the project sounded like utter crap. Another character cut from whole cardboard. Piper sighed to himself. Regardless, it was a shop window. FaceTime. He hadn't worked, not a single television commercial or cartoon voiceover, nothing, for almost a year, and he was seriously underwater on his condo. If need be, he'd surrender his career to sad independent productions. Pilots that never got picked up by a network. He'd kowtow to film school auteurs funded with legalized marijuana money, who didn't know a key light from a lens filter. Thus, he'd always find himself reblocking every scene and advising the cameraman, teaching the director how to imply a counter-narrative through placement of the principal actors. Granted, today's hiring crew looked to be a notch below even the usual Hollywood outsider types. The men who shook his hand abraded his palm with their calluses. They smelled of sweat. They drank cans of beer at a folding table as they loudly argued the merits of each actor. Their fingernails were rimmed with dirt, and no surgeon had injected dermal fillers or stretched the skin to erase the creases in their unsmiling, sun-damaged faces. The casting director was named Clem. Just Clem. His knuckles were brown with scabs of dried blood, and he looked more like a shop steward. Clem shook Piper's manicured hand and gave him the audition script. He'd liked Piper's performance as Ronald Reagan, the time he'd played him in a cable network documentary about the president being shot. Clem pumped his hand and gushed, "You were great. The way you grabbed your guts and kept not dying for 2 hours." A man with a broken nose and mutilated cauliflower ears like cabbages stuck to either side of his bald head stepped up and introduced himself as the cinematographer. His name was LeManley. Nobody gave a last name. LeManley had a D's and Doe's accent and a swastika tattooed on the side of his thick neck. LeManley looked Piper up and down and muttered, "Sweet threads." The casting call had dictated for applicants to wear a suit and tie as befitted the leader of the free world. Combed hair, shined shoes. Piper took this to heart and broke out his best Savile Row single-breasted. A quick assessment of the competition assured him he might get the role based on his suit alone. The others here to read were romantic leads past their prime. Handsome men who'd skated on their lantern jaws and jutting brows. They were wooden actors who specialized in wooden characters, judges, lawyers, family doctors. When someone called his name, Piper took his mark before the video camera. A poster stood on a tripod beside it. The handwritten lines ran like a list under the heading, "Read the Below." An assistant director put his eye to the viewfinder as if checking the focus. With one hand, he directed Piper to move sideways a half step. The man wore a plaid flannel shirt, unbuttoned, and as he bent over the viewfinder, the shirt fell open to reveal a stained wife-beater t-shirt and a shoulder holster containing a pistol. The assistant director pointed a stubby index finger, making his hand like a fleshy gun, and signaled to begin. The thuggish crew sat at a nearby table and watched him on monitors. "Fellow citizens," Piper began, channeling his best Reagan, "I speak to you as the head of your new government." The secret to doing Reagan was to keep a slight burr in his voice. "Throughout history, power has been earned. Another Reagan rule was that the silence between words was as important, perhaps even more important, than the words themselves. Historically, power was awarded, Piper continued, to those who demonstrated it. None but the best warriors were crowned. Piper lowered his chin almost imperceptibly. Now politics has degraded power to a popularity contest. By gazing up, his pupils half hidden under his tilted down brow, he implied disdain. The menacing disapproval of a caveman whose eyes were so deep set as to be lost. The small group of actors waiting their turn could learn a valuable lesson. Piper had played Lear. He'd played Moses. Until today, he lectured, modern leaders have pandered for their position instead of fighting to earn it. He paused, letting the words take root. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, Piper said. It was a tricky segue. A better writer would have made a smoother transition, but an actor who knew his craft could always fix the flaws in bad writing. Often by simply repeating the opening phrase thus, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, global forces have imposed a great standardization on humanity. Without breaking eye contact with the camera, Piper could sense the repetition was a success. The casting director nodded and jotted a note in his script. Two other men, a producer and the screenwriter, exchanged smiles and cocked eyebrows. No feet were bouncing with impatience. No one drummed his fingertips on the table. Even the director ceased chewing the donut he'd been stuffing into his mouth. Piper continued, in our lifetime, we've lived under the tyranny of standardized time zones, standardized measurements for temperature and distance, required codes of behavior, and approved methods of expression. There was no ellipse here, but Piper added it so the subsequent passage would have greater effect. These universal conventions have robbed us of our lives. Here he smiled to indicate a new segue. Piper watched the digital counter on the camera. They wanted this brought home in 4 minutes, and he would hit that mark exactly. The heroic acts of today have freed us from the tyranny of long-standing conventions. He drawled each word, stretched it, savored it, to give the message a Roosevelt fireside chat jovialness. From today forward, the people who run our nation are proven heroes. Piper's inflection turned patronizing, pure Hyde Park smug, dismissive of any fears his audience might harbor. To land the speech, he punched it up with JFK bombast. These new leaders are the warriors who have delivered us all, he half shouted. For generations to come, these liberators will steer our nation's new course of freedom. These words, Piper knew they didn't need to make sense. They only needed to evoke a positive emotional reaction. From this great day, he decreed. His voice sounded as if it issued from a granite mouth on Mount Rushmore. It seemed to echo across time like the Gettysburg Address. From this great day, we reject the leveling and dumbing down imposed by global standards, and we devote our lives. Piper paused as if overcome with emotion. To the restoration of our identity and our sovereignty. A decent actor stays true to the script. A great actor knows when to improvise and drive home a point the writer has overlooked. Going off script would either scuttle this job or clinch it. Giving the camera an LBJ glower, Piper ad-libbed. Before we can create anything of lasting value, we must first create ourselves. Still gazing squarely into the lens, he added, "I thank you." 4 minutes, exactly. The room erupted with applause. The rough-hewn crew members rose to stand, whistling and stomping booted feet. Even Piper's competition, his fellow actors who'd been sitting on the sidelines awaiting their turns to read, even they begrudgingly applauded his triumph. The knuckle-dragging casting director, Clem, lurched forward, his meaty face wreathed with a smile. He slapped Piper on the back, saying, "Your bit about creating ourselves. Sheer brilliance." He thrust forward a sheet of printed paper, saying, "Before you leave your mark," indicating the masking tape on the floor, "would you read this into the camera as well?" With rough, scarred fingers, Clem offered a white index card. Written on it was a single sentence. Piper read the words and handed it back. He fixed the camera with a stern gaze and delivered the line, "Do not seek it out," Piper proclaimed. "The list does not exist." From off camera, the director said, "Next line." Piper read, "A smile is your best bulletproof vest." A still photographer hovered in his peripheral vision, snapping pictures. The director ordered, "Keep rolling. Next line." Piper narrowed his eyes and gave the camera a sage look before reading, "The divine wages a constant battle to prove itself to us." Minus a context, he performed his best, reading, "Those who demand peace are the people who already hold power." They made him repeat the list of jingoistic slogans until he knew them by heart and was no longer reading. He was reciting. Without pause, a gopher handed him a large blue-black book. It was roughly the size of a coffee table album, the type usually filled with glossy artwork. The cover was blank save for the title in gilded lettering. Adjustment Day, by Talbot Reynolds. His character. The photographer snapped pictures of him holding the book open, taken from every angle and distance. No one applauded, but a sense of their deep nodding approval filled the room. Before Piper could leave his mark, the director told him to read from the first page. Piper studied the text. Printed across the top of the page in large typeface was "Declaration of Interdependence." There were no protesters. The National Mall stretching from the Capitol building to the Washington Monument, it should have been filled with protesters. Milling, chanting, sign-waving, hippy-dippy hordes. Millions of anti-war demonstrators. The phones in his office. The office of Senator Holbrook Daniels on the fifth floor of the Hart Senate office building. The phone should be ringing off the hook. The phones were silent. None of the millions of furious emails his staff had expected were appearing in his senatorial inbox. No. The only sign of activity was a small crew of construction workers. From his high window, Senator Daniels watched them excavating a wide trench. It was roughly the dimensions of two Olympic-sized swimming pools placed end to end. The work was taking place on the lawn between First Avenue and the Capitol steps. The stupid blue-collar slobs doing the digging, the senator almost pitied them. He settled into a leather desk chair in his air-conditioned, public-financed inner sanctum. If they weren't going to die off soon, their sons would be. Their sons and grandsons or nephews, their apprentices and their journeymen, the surplus males of a generation. With the vote on the National War Resolution only days away, angry and frightened Americans should have been beating down his door. None were. Not only was his office silent, but every office in the building seemed as hushed as a church. His assistants and pages had checked with the switchboard and the IT guys. The phones and servers were working. His best guess was that Americans were too fractured along the fault lines of personal identity politics. It seemed that no one cared about others being compelled to gird their loins and perish. Recent politics had effectively branded young men as an internal enemy. Perpetrators of rape culture, school shooters, and neo-Nazis. And media-frightened Americans were glad to see these bad apples culled. The mass media had done its state-instructed job to demonize draft-age men, greasing the skids for their induction. Before the end of this week, elected federal officials would vote unanimously to reinstate the military draft and commit 2 million young men to fighting a war in North Africa. Likewise, the leaders of a dozen countries in West Africa and the Middle East would pit an equal number of young men against the Americans. Grim, but true. Rumor had it that this would be the fastest world war in history. Once the combatants were mustered along the battlefront, a thermonuclear strike would eradicate everyone involved. A non-existent terrorist group would be blamed for the nuke, and the warring nations would withdraw with no loss of face. The war would be declared a draw. Yet another war to end all wars. From his office window, Daniels marveled at how fast the pit was being dug. In D.C., public works projects lasted for years, while the parties involved lined their pockets with taxpayer money. Whatever motivated the crew just across Constitution Avenue, it had to be something beyond the monetary. Even as he watched, the earth-moving equipment sunk deeper, almost out of sight, as the mound of dirt grew taller along one edge of the vast hole. The plans for this war had been unfolding since the first of the millennial generation had been born. The Census Bureau had recognized that the millennials would be the largest demographic in national history. They'd be healthy and well-educated, and eventually, they'd all want respect and power. The dynamic had played itself out in countries like Rwanda and Ivory Coast, where surplus young men had sparked civil wars until the national infrastructure had been destroyed and the entire population reduced to grinding poverty. For a time, American officials had kept the lid on this human powder keg by dosing the boys with Ritalin. After that, peace came in the form of endless online gaming and pornography, all covertly supplied by government contractors. Despite those efforts, this generation was waking up to its mortality. They wanted more than drug time-wasting numbness. Unless the United States could resolve a sizable portion of its restless bad boy problem, this nation would be doomed to the same misery as Haiti and Nigeria. America's version of the Arab Spring was just around the next corner. Today, the millennial males were already committing skyrocketing rates of violent crime in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. They were hacking into state secrets, so it was vital to implement the new war and purge the youth bulge. If the public ever caught wind of this plan, it might lead to a revolution. Families fighting to save their sons, men fighting to save themselves. As far as their loved ones need know, these young men would die heroes. They'd venture into battle like their forefathers and sacrifice their lives for the comfort and security of their fellow Americans back home. The senator looked down on the workmen digging away in the afternoon sun, sweating in the humid Potomac summer. He smirked, considering how in a few weeks there would be a sizable surplus of women. Feminism would fade out, and ladies would have to play nice or risk dying alone and being devoured by their cats. Less social upheaval, more available babes. For Senator Daniels and men like him, the war resolution was a win-win. Far below him, the laborers swarmed like ants, like obedient drones doing the bidding of their master. At last, the reality of their project dawned on the senator. It was obvious. They were preemptively building a memorial to the soldiers who'd be dead by Halloween. This was someone's extremely efficient idea. Rising from that ominous pit would be a white marble confection of Greco-Roman statues and columns, the usual emotionally cathartic frou-frou. It made sense to begin construction now, even before the war was declared. The faster the dead could be honored, the faster they could be forgotten. Here was an expedited shrine, being erected even before the college students and pizza delivery boys and skateboarders received their draft notices. Proactively, their names were already being chiseled into marble plaques to honor the dead. Now the world made perfect logical sense. And slowly, between the softness of his leather chair, the lull of the air conditioning, and the unassailed silence of his office, Senator Holbrook Daniels drifted to sleep. Frankie's dad told him that sometimes firemen need to burn down a bad house on purpose in order to save a good neighborhood. A type of backburn, they called it when fighting forest fires. The father and son had been driving around in the white fire marshal car with the special sticker on the back window and the red light on the dashboard, except the light wasn't switched on. They drove past spray-painted houses, houses with wood nailed over the gone windows, houses where only a basement was left, like a swimming pool filled with weeds and trees growing inside. They drove to Frankie's old school from before he started remote learning on the computer in their kitchen at home. After the day that Frankie's dad called the last straw. After a bunch of kids dogpiled him at lunch. After they took turns stomping his head against the lunchroom floor. Something Frankie couldn't remember, even after the teachers had shown them the lunchroom video and the camera movies some kids had posted to World Star Hip Hop. Today, same as before, his dad brought a super soaker, the deluxe model with the bigger tank, made to shoot longer and farther. Firemen have a special key, his dad showed him. It opens every door. Another special key shuts off the security alarm. He told Frankie not to mind about the security videos. The high-up cameras watched them go down every hallway, walking past Frankie's old locker, past the spot where nobody did anything besides videotape him getting his face stomped. Any trace of blood had been scrubbed away. Same as usual, his dad worked the pump action on the super soaker, spraying every bulletin board hung with paper, hosing every school spirit banner with that service station smell. As they strolled the hallway, Frankie's dad squirt-gunned the smell of filling the lawnmower and cleaning paintbrushes. He sprayed the ceiling tiles until they were so saturated they warped and sagged. This was his secret recipe of styrofoam ground down to just its little white balls, dissolved in gasoline with Vaseline stirred in to make it thick, to make it sticky so when he sprayed the gunk on the ceiling, it never dripped, and when he sprayed it on window glass, it didn't run down. He'd added some paint thinner as a surfactant, his dad explained, to break the surface tension so the ooze wouldn't bead up, but would coat everything more evenly. It was summer vacation, so Frankie knew no hamsters or goldfish lived in any classroom. His dad took aim and soaked a security camera that was spying on them. After the day of the lunchroom beatdown, Frankie couldn't remember. His dad never looked at him. If his dad looked in his direction, all he saw was the scar that now ran down the side of Frankie's face. A red line shaped like the curved edge of a Nike basketball shoe, where the cheek skin had torn. Even now, walking down the empty summer hallway lined with lockers but no padlocks, Frankie could feel his dad sneak looks at the scar. Frankie's dad never smiled at him, not after that day. He scowled, but he was scowling at the scar, the ghost of that final last stomp, the last day in public school. Lining the halls, big posters showed smiling kids from every place on the planet, holding hands under a rainbow, with covering the rainbow, the words, "Love comes in every color." His dad hosed the poster. Doing so, the look on his dad's face was worse than any scar. From his expression, he wanted to be spraying this fire juice into the eyes and mouths of those kids who'd left their footprints on Frankie for the rest of his life. The whole time Frankie's dad super-soakered the school walls, he yelled stuff like, "Eat it, cultural Marxism," and "Get fucked, vibrant ethnic diversity." His father hosed the poster until it sagged and slid down the wet wall. By then the soaker was empty, and he pitched it a long ways, almost all the way to the school office. "In a little bit, kid," said Frankie's father. "I'm going to do you a solid one." Frankie couldn't picture that. The kids who'd kicked his ass, they still went here. None of them had been sent home. But it helped to know that after today, nobody would go here. "Maybe they caught us off guard once," his dad said. "But we'll get our revenge." Frankie followed his dad into a bathroom and waited while he washed his hands. His dad said, "Nobody is going to shit on this family ever again." Before they went out to the car, his dad took out his phone and placed a call. He said, "Hello, may I speak to your news director?" With one hand, he dug in his pants pocket. "This is Fire Marshal Benjamin Hugh. We're currently responding to reports that the Golden Park Elementary School is ablaze." From his pocket, he withdrew a book of matches. He ended the call and placed another. "Hello, may I speak to the city desk?" Frankie's father held the matches out to his son. Frankie took them. Waiting, his father turned away from the phone and said, "Today is just practice, just to see how many show up." Into the phone, he said, "I've got word that arsonists have struck another local school." He listened. "It's Golden Park Elementary." Frankie stood by, holding the matches, just as he'd stood by at Madison Middle School, and Immaculate Heart, and the three schools before. Frankie figured this would be the last school, and that his dad had only burned the others, so this one wouldn't look special. When his dad was finished with the last phone call, then Frankie knew what came next. In his heart, Frankie knew that the bad parts of the world would have to be burned away to save the best parts. "Frankie, you..." His dad knelt in front of him and took both of Frankie's small hands in his own, saying, "Son, these dipshits will pay you tribute for the rest of your life." He let fall one of the small hands and reached up to stroke the scar on the side of Frankie's innocent, trusting face. "My boy, you will grow to become a king, and your sons will be princes." He lifted the one small hand he still held and put it to his own lips. As a special treat, his father let Frankie light the match. After that, they went outside to count how many reporters and cameramen would show up. At first, it was only a couple television crews. But now every station came, plus some foreigners in town for the serial arson story. The newspaper sent a team, even a helicopter. Radio stations sent people. Frankie's dad took notes and strategized his clearest angles and best shots to see how easy his work would be when the actual day came. Only then did Frankie's dad dial 911. Before everything you've read so far in this book, before this book was a book, it was the dream of Walter Baines. Back in the world you still know, back in before